Nonprofit organizations abound all over the world, but often in a zone between government agencies and for-profit ventures. Our next guest not only trains people to lead nonprofits, he envisions a future in which most or all businesses will be not-for-profit. Let's get some idea of how that would work and what the training is like now. Donnie McClurkin is the director of the Cascades Hub, based at Southern Oregon University, with some training coming up fairly soon. Donnie McClurkin, good to see you once again.
Delighted to be here. Thanks, Jeff.
For the folks who don't know, what is Cascades Hub?
It's a co-working space that we set up last year at Southern Oregon University, with a focus for nonprofit organizations and people who are generally considering themselves as change makers. We provide training opportunities to help people launch or sustain their initiatives.
You know, it's so easy to get you started. All I had to do was look at the title for the first event you have in your training series coming up starting this week, Applying an Asset-Based Approach to Social Change. We're not talking necessarily tangible assets, and this got us into a discussion of how a lot of nonprofits start, which from a lot of people's perceptions is you see a problem or a need in your community, and you set up to address that need, which then tends to be thinking in somewhat negative terms in the first place.
That's right. There's a wonderful approach called asset-based community development, which is spreading around the world. And essentially it says if you start by looking at what's working within your community, if you've got some idea for something that needs improving, but you begin with what's working, it's actually a much more empowering process, because you end up looking at things from a space of resilience and what we already have and what you can leverage in that process, rather than deficit model thinking, which is we don't have this, we don't have that. And essentially a lot of nonprofit organizations get into that bad habit at the beginning of we're addressing a problem, we're trying to fix this, we don't have any resources at our disposal, and so they immediately say we need funding. But often organizations that look internally at what they already have can find they can reduce their costs and their overheads by accessing, you know, a printer that someone has access to within their group, or a newsletter service that someone is willing to offer through their business, for example. So starting with the strengths of the people who connect first to form a nonprofit is a much more empowering process.
There's a lot about surveying the landscape in this approach, it sounds like, rather than just focusing narrowly on what the mission of the organization is at first, to say, okay, who else is doing something like this?
Absolutely. I mean, part of looking at the strengths that exist in a community is mapping the space, as you're pointing out. And so often you hear people say, look, we don't want to reinvent the wheel, but they end up doing exactly that because they don't take time to quickly map what's actually happening in their community already.
So so in the future that you envision, of course, this kind of slops over into your other job as the head of the Institute for, was it?
Post-Growth Institute.
Yeah. Where you envision a future where pretty much everything is nonprofit?
We're seeing a dramatic trend happening in our global economy at the moment where business models that have the privatization of wealth, where there's private owners that extract wealth out of the economy, are essentially becoming less competitive. And the models that are becoming more competitive are ones where there's purpose that sits underneath the business model, and any excess wealth that is gained after salaries have been paid and administrative overheads have gone through goes back into the community. So that redistribution of wealth is actually proving central to the business models that are competitive in the future.
But if you end up in a series of, or in a place where so many things are nonprofit, who pays corporate taxes then?
So this is often forgotten that, of course, individuals who work for nonprofits pay their taxes, and nonprofits also pay certain taxes themselves, although not corporate business tax. But actually, there's the incredible thing is that so much of the corporate tax that's supposedly raised in the U.S. at the moment goes straight to debt repayment in terms of the national debt that the government's in. But also, it's a much smaller amount than people realize as a percentage of overall income. And often, the intention of corporate tax is to pay for public services. Well, nonprofit organizations provide those public services, so they offset the need, in fact, to actually raise that kind of finance.
So give us an idea of some of the nonprofits you've been working with and some of the things they have focused on. And it sounds like focus is, again, a large part of this, is making sure that they're really making clear right from the get-go what they're going to do, and not just like, we want to help X, but to get more narrowly focused on exactly how.
Absolutely. So we've been working with climate change organizations, arts-based organizations, animal welfare organizations. And often what we'll do at the very beginning is we'll run branding processes. And so we're bringing aspects from for-profit business and typically some of your bigger corporations into the nonprofit sphere, and we're saying, let's have a look here at what your brand would actually look like, not just in terms of what you're trying to address, but all the aspects, its personality, what its benefits are for users. And there's a really exciting innovation that we are bringing from Silicon Valley here to the Rogue Valley that I'm really happy to be sharing with others, and it's called the Lean Development Approach. So the standard approach, if you live in the Valley and you've got some social issue that you want to address, you say, let's get a bunch of people together and essentially form a group, and then let's try to raise a whole lot of money to then run a trial. But the Lean Development Approach out of Silicon Valley says, let's start with the smallest prototype we can that allows us to learn from the process. And so instead of creating some kind of big event to raise $30,000, $40,000 to then run a service, for example, like a new food bank or something like that, you instead would go out into a street with perhaps a sandwich and you would test what the response is from the public to that service on its very smallest process. And you're not trying to look for success here. You're actually trying to look for learning as much as possible from the process and multiple rounds of feedback. And in the process, you're focusing your idea very early on. You're customizing it without putting in a whole lot of energy and expenditure.
So, for example, the animal welfare organization that you mentioned, how would they go about testing their idea?
So,
how did they, I guess, is the bigger question.
They're one that's been around for some time, and I need to keep at liberty their confidentiality around the kinds of things they're doing. But essentially, if a group like that wanted to trial, for example, a new process on their property, like maybe growing produce and then sharing some of that produce with the people who are coming to pick up animals for adoption, say, rather than doing a massive field production process, you would actually just go through planting one crop in one small area, maybe just one or two plants, and you would see how does it respond on a weekly basis to what you're doing. And then at the end, if you have a couple of tomatoes, let's say, you would then pass those to someone who comes to the property and see if they want to purchase it, what they buy it for, what price, what their response is. Rather than investing a whole lot of energy, you might have put in an hour's work over the space of a month to produce a couple of tomatoes that are then going to be engaged with a market in a way that can test whether that's been an effective use of time.
So does this end up in a process where you get a lot of little ideas being tried out rather than people having to feel like they get together and get a big idea out of this organization?
Exactly. And that's really conducive to organizations where you have a lot of people with a lot of great ideas. And typically organizations, when they put so much emphasis and energy into just one big idea, leave a lot of people in boards or on management teams feeling a little unsatisfied that their idea didn't get tested. This is an opportunity to rapidly prototype whole lot of ideas to see what really sticks.
Donnie McClurkin's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about the training programs that he offers through the Cascades Hub at Southern Oregon University for nonprofit programs and the people who work for them. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about nonprofits today and nonprofits in the future, where Donnie envisions a lot more nonprofits. 800-838-3760 to reach us by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Is there anything you're keeping from the playbook of how nonprofits were done before? I mean, I get the sense of like, that's it, you know, we're ripping this out and ripping out these pages and putting all new stuff in.
No, we're definitely using that asset-based approach ourselves and looking at what's worked. And what's usually worked well are things like Robert's Rules of Order for board meetings. Is a very tried and tested process that allows for board organizations to run effective meetings.
So you're not trying to turn it into Occupy Wall Street?
Absolutely
like
not. No, in fact, we look at finding a really fine balance between the unstructuredness of something like Occupy that had a lot of passion underneath it and the old traditional ways of nonprofit organizations that do work. And so you'll find that many organizations in the past did a really good job of outlining their mission, but typically in the age of information overload, lots of organizations are drifting away from that mission. And so returning to their roots and rediscovering what was the founding document, for example, or the founding purpose that sits underneath this often proves a really valuable part of the process of re-identifying and reimagining an organization.
Going back to the mission statement and the goals and that sort of thing?
Absolutely.
So how much do you refine those, though, in this new nonprofit world you envision? Because if you're talking about looking at what you got and going for a lean development approach, for example, you might not shoot for as big a mission in the first place, for example.
Well, what's fascinating about what's happening in this sphere is that more and more organizations are realizing that they need to have their clientele or their supporters participate in that process of creating the mission. So often through social media or through face-to-face meetings, there's feedback mechanisms that are happening there about what people want a brand to be. And that needs to be balanced with what the original intention is and what the changing scope is in the digital era. So often, for example, an organization that was originally founded to provide a certain service is now staring at a very different scenario with the capacity for awareness raising to go out so much faster through YouTube, through Facebook, through Twitter, etc. And so that often changes their mission in the sense of allowing them to do public outreach more effectively and then focus a little more behind the scenes on the actual activities they might be doing in a physical location.
So assuming they're paying attention to the results they're getting from their original market testing, which is what my name for it, perhaps not yours, but just seeing out how what people feel about their idea, they're going to go through several stages of refinement potentially before they even put the idea out there or put the organization together on you know, lock up what they're pointing toward.
That's ideal. In fact, this course that we're running starting next week through the Cascades Hub, we ran it last year. And what I did at the end of every single workshop was provide the participants with an opportunity to provide feedback. And that's refined this project and what it is becoming so dramatically. And that's exactly what nonprofits that are more and more effective are doing on an increasing basis.
As you point out, in this age of the internet and social media, you can get ideas out there faster without having to pay a lot of money or go through a lot of filters of other media. So the life cycle and idea can actually be shorter. For that matter, are the life cycles of nonprofits perhaps shorter now if their missions are achieved sooner?
Well, we'd hope to think so. I'm not quite sure. I haven't seen any statistics on life cycles for nonprofit organizations. I certainly know there's a lot more of them, and that means that you would think that there would be an attrition rate that's higher given a saturation of the market. But also, unfortunately, we're dealing with greater social issues as a result of the fallout from the economic system we're inhabiting.
So if you take a look at the landscape and realize there are six organizations that do this, but they're missing this one portion that we think we could address, where do you then suggest they go? Do they go ahead and form themselves up as a nonprofit and aim for that thing, or do they talk to the existing six organizations and say, maybe you guys could do this?
They do something in between both of those. What they do is they can map the space, essentially, and put down those six other organizations on some kind of physical map, some axes, you know, written across a piece of paper. And then they can show to those organizations, go and present them and say, we believe that this is the lay of the land in this space, and here's a space that we'd like to inhabit. And then what's amazing is that there's new forms of financing that are emerging called such as collective impact, where organizations will only get funding from a philanthropic supporter if they have been able to show that they're working in collaboration with a number of other organizations to effectively address something systematically. And so I think there's real hope for organizations that feel they have the missing piece for some kind of social issue with existing organizations to join in with each other, but to do so in a visual way that allows other organizations who are often very protective of their space to say, oh, right, yes, thanks for identifying where you see us fit. And yeah, we agree there's a space there for you to join in.
I was going to ask you about philanthropic works and foundations. Donnie McClurkin's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about the future of nonprofits. He gives training for nonprofits starting this week through Cascades Hub in Ashland. If you get to a situation in the future, this post-growth idea that you have where there aren't very many profit-making operations, okay, go ahead.
Well, the organizations will be profit-making. Mm-hmm. They're just not private profit-making. Uh-huh. So organizations with, yeah.
So would there be less private wealth, I guess, was the question, and for that matter, then less foundation money around for the kind of philanthropic works that help nonprofits continue theirs?
Well, it was so interesting listening, sitting in the studio this morning and hearing that one of the financial supporters of JPR is Providence Hospital. Providence is a nonprofit organization. And so I think part of the future is where nonprofit organizations that have finance revenue models that sit underneath their activities are actually donating to other nonprofit organizations as a way to fill some of the gap of what might be lost with private individuals who are quite wealthy.
Oh, okay. So the nonprofits that do reasonably well and put some stuff in the bank and then share with other nonprofits that have needs.
We're already seeing that around the world on an increasing basis.
So who are the people who come to these training sessions? These are multi-week training sessions. This starts in March and runs through the early July. But are you getting people from newer nonprofits, older nonprofits, a mix?
Well, in fact, it's not even just nonprofit people. It's anyone who's interested in creating social change. And we often talk about nonprofit being a much broader category than people understand. So it's not just 501c3 organizations. It's anyone who wants to start the equivalent of the next food co-op or the next credit union, which are both not-for-profit institutions. So anything where you don't have private individuals as owners anything in that basket is encouraged in terms of people joining us. But if you're interested in activism or creating change in your community any way, shape or form, you're encouraged to come along. And we get people of all ages, all walks of life. I think for the signups that we have at the moment, it's probably a 30% student base. Maybe 50% of people are involved in nonprofits and 20% have some kind of idea, but others are just interested. We even have from time to time people who run for-profit businesses that are looking to shift over to the not-for-profit status.
Really? Okay, we've got about a minute left. I want to ask about the session. I'm presenting like a TED speaker. Some sharpening up.
Yeah, that's an exciting process that we trialed last year, where essentially we realized that if you want to give a 10-15 minute speech, you can really do it effectively by learning from the beginning the processes of how body movement, body shape, positioning, etc. works. And we do it by people presenting in public in silence. So they actually present in front of a public audience without actually saying any words, and it's amazing in terms of the results.
Wow. I think I would like to see that. Do you get pretty good? Do you have any slots left in the not-for-profit way thing this time?
We have a couple of places left. We're almost full, but if people are interested, they can go to cascadeshub.org and find out a little more about our training, which begins this Wednesday.
Donnie McClurkin is the head of Cascades Hub, and always a pleasure to talk to you on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks, Jeff.